From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll talk with artist Jillian Ludwig about her work.
I'll chat with composer Aaron J. Kernis, who's coming to Indiana.
And I'll meet two art teachers who want you to know what art does for us. And of course, there's our arts calendar we call, What Do We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Originally from Illinois, artist Jillian Ludwig has studied, worked, and taught everywhere from South Carolina to Texas to France before settling, at least temporarily, in Lafayette, Indiana. Her first show in Indianapolis at Wug Lacoo's studio and garage space is titled Fam Farm and reflects on the loss of natural farming in our culture. Travis DiNicola spoke with her about her work.
Jillian, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you in our studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Really excited about the show that you've got coming up at Wug Lacoo's studio and garage space. It's a crazy space over there, just sort of off of Mass Avenue. The show that that you have coming up, it's your first in Indianapolis, right?
Correct.
And it's Fam Farm is the title?
Yes, which is kind of abbreviation, a little bit of Family Farm.
Family Farm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the specific show in just a minute, but before we do, tell me a little bit more about your background. I know you've traveled quite a lot, taught mm-hmm. many places, studied lots of places, worked lots of places. Now you've been in Indiana for not quite a year or so, up in Lafayette.
Mm-hmm.
How's that going?
it's well. It's going well. I got my master's degree at Clemson University. And I concentrated primarily in drawing, and I got my Bachelor's of Fine Arts at Bradley University in Peoria, mm-hmm. where I concentrated on drawing and printmaking, but I have done a lot of painting. And I guess through, you know, art opportunities as well as following my husband around, I've gotten a lot of opportunities to travel. And we spent last year in France, in Lyon, and I just concentrated primarily on studio work, which mm-hmm. was totally different than teaching adjunct in Texas, which we came from in Austin. And through, you know, I don't know how many years of just concentrated schooling. So I feel like I've been a professional artist for about 2 years. And, you know, I tried the teaching, which is awesome. The economy is not too awesome with artists
sure.
right now, but yeah, I'm concentrating primarily on my art right now.
Now, it looks like, I mean, from what I've seen and on your website, the bulk of your work recently, at least, has been primarily drawing, not painting?
Yes, primarily drawing. I think that's due to, you know, the studio space. You
mm-hmm.
know, for painting, it just takes a larger space, you know, proper ventilation. You got to be able to get messy. And with drawing, for me, it's more of,
you can sort of take it anywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like this romantic idea of, like, it's just paper and pencil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I can do that anywhere. And considering we've traveled so much and all of that, I think it's really appropriate for me to concentrate on things that I can move with, you know, I can travel with. And also, I think I've kind of come to this realization is that the older I'm getting, the more, I guess, the format seems to be really important to me. Like, a painting
mm-hmm.
is loud and lots of colors, and it can be big, and I feel like I'm more in a place that a smaller format, something quieter, kind of fits my personality maybe a little bit more right
well,
now.
I wanted to ask you even just about the size and the scale of the work that you're doing, and again, we'll talk about this specifically in just a minute, but is most of it a little bit smaller? I mean, these aren't, like, enormous pieces.
Most of it is about 22 by 30,
okay.
And I really like when one person looks at my drawing at a time,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it that format, when you have, like, a really large painting or a really large drawing, you get three or four people looking at it at one time, and it's sort of, for me, it sort of loses that intimacy, kind of like a book,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, when you look at a book, it's just you and that book, and I think because my drawings are so detailed,
mm-hmm.
you want to get up close to it, you know, and it's kind of the lure of it's what makes me excited about the drawing is that one-on-one sort
yeah.
of intimacy.
Well, I can certainly see that, and a lot of your drawings are, I mean, very detailed, as you said. You know, at sort of first glance, they're just these, you know, incredibly, you know, technical, well illustrated, highly realistic pieces. And then you sort of look at it a little bit closer, and you realize that something's sort of askew in each one in a different way.
Definitely, and I
yeah.
think, you know, like I have such an appreciation for people that can really master their craft, and
mm-hmm.
it's and they really show. The viewers, like, I've studied this and I know this well. But I also, you know, if I wanted to make something really photorealistic, I would just take a photo. That's just my way. But if I wanted to sort of insert this weird surrealism that I can never find in a photo, I have to draw it. That's kind of sort of the magic within a drawn piece to me is, like, capturing something that's it looks natural, but
mm-hmm.
it's not. Like, and it can never be so. You know, so I like making these sort of realistic renderings of something that is not realistic.
It can only exist on that paper.
Exactly.
And that's really what I saw with sort of the preview of Fam Farm. The work that's included there features a lot of well, sort of, you know, farm animals, whether it be pigs or chicks.
Mm-hmm.
But then something's not quite right.
Totally. And, okay, so I got in this little spiel of watching a lot of documentaries about food and, you know, how,
like
where,
Food Inc.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Food Inc. Mm-hmm. was huge. I was really, that kind of jostled me a little bit just in terms of, you know, like labeling and
where does our food come
where
from?
Where is our food coming
yeah.
from? What are they being fed? And, that particular documentary, I really think is, why I did Fam Farm. And
okay.
it's a reflection of, you know, where our food's coming from and, you know, kind of the scary things that go along with that. And so a lot of these chicks and a lot of these pigs are being wrapped in these pink ribbons, these pink, flowy, lovely ribbons. And for me, that symbolizes this sort of strange way of labeling. Like,
mm-hmm.
it looks really pretty and nice, but for some reason, I'm not getting the information that I really want. It just looks nice. And for
right.
me, that was kind of this poetic way of describing this false labeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, okay, now I'm not entirely sure. This was like a month ago. I saw this huge bag of Tyson chicken. You know, great, wonderful. But there was like part of it that was labeled green. I don't understand what's green about this. You know, is this a sort of weird labeling that
yeah.
that's describing something environmental because green has associations of being environmental? I'm not really sure, but it's for someone that's not really looking or someone that's not really reading, they can like have that quick marketing association. Oh, this must be good. You know, this must be good for me and the environment, you know, so
yeah.
that's the bother. It's
and as you said, I mean, with these images, by sort of wrapping, you know, a pig with a pink ribbon and putting a bow on it, it's sort of like this pretty package that's presented to you, but at the same time, you realize the pig's not really that happy right now.
No.
No.
And, yeah, and, like, and there's certain parts where I find, you know, as someone that's visual, that I really like certain details, like when the ribbon presses into the pig's skin,
yeah.
and there's, like, a fold there that does not look comfortable.
No.
But you know, it's that sort of thing where it looks pleasant from afar, but the
right.
second you start looking at
and
the
really
drawing,
paying attention,
more, there's something a little bit weird.
Well, like the chicks, I mean, they're losing their hair or
being plucked.
Yeah,
something
not hair
where,
or feathers. Like
yeah,
chicks, but
I mean, it's that idea of like there's a human influence in
yeah.
the drawing.
Yeah.
You know, that whether it's a synthetic ribbon or whether it's these plucked areas, there's something that's happening. But I think for me, when I look at an image that looks kind of violent or scary, I don't want to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and these don't at all.
And that's for me, that's the key, is
yeah.
I kind of wanted to make it playful. Like,
yeah.
okay, I'm just sort of playing around with the idea. It's not upsetting. In fact, I, you know, I look at it and my sister who just had a baby is like, oh, I want one to put in the baby's room because there's something sort of cute
yeah.
and pleasant about it. But also kind of upsetting at the same time.
Now, do you have a history of coming from a family that was in farming at all? Or, I mean, you mentioned, of course, I mean, the movies, and there's been a lot more attention given to you know, eating locally and locavores and
totally.
And such. But
well, although my dad's from Iowa and he grew
mm-hmm.
up on a farm, I didn't experience that. What I did experience was living in South Carolina and meeting my husband's family, and just the knowledge of the part of the South that I saw, mm-hmm. you know, the knowledge that comes with providing for yourself, and you know, his particular family having a garden, and just things that I never knew growing up in Chicago. Like, I knew how to parallel park. I didn't know, you know, these different kinds of flowers and these different, like, I how to can or preserve food. And
right.
to me, that was just so magical.
So this is really sort of a process of discovery you're going through right now.
Definitely.
But now, animals aren't totally new in your work. I mean, I've seen some illustrations of elephants. And,
oh, yeah. I when I lived in Lyon, I lived right next to an animal park.
Uh-huh.
And one, I was just amazed with these elephants. Because they have that weird combination of being so graceful
mm-hmm.
and, like, they look so clumsy, though, at the same time. You know, like, I heard something where they kind of walk on their tippy toes, essentially, because their bones are sort of angled in a way that it looks like they're walking on their tippy toes.
Yeah.
But they have this padding underneath, and it's just that idea of something graceful and something clunky. I like that idea of putting things that I think are totally opposite and smashing them together, and an elephant totally symbolizes that for me.
Well, I'm trying to think. Some of the illustrations I've seen, the drawings you've done of elephants almost look like they're dancing.
Yes, and that was the first
year, like a balletic quality too.
Definitely, and yeah. That was the first year of my marriage, and a lot of so I took these elephants and sort of thought of them as me and my husband, and, you know, thought of them as portraits of us, and sort of this deranged dance of love and support, and, you know, this heavy weight of, like, we're never going to leave each other. You know what I mean? That first year of
But neither of you are built like elephants. So with your work, one thing that I really enjoy about what I've seen so far is that when I look at it, my mind starts conjuring a story. With each of the pieces, it feels like there should be a story there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you've ever considered, either
yes.
you know, illustrating a story or writing stories based on your work?
Oh my gosh, that's like, I can't tell you how much it's such a big dream of mine to
yeah.
somehow make this amazing, sweet children's book. And it could be like this Edward Gorey, weird, quirky children's book.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be, you know, like this moral, amazing. You know what I mean? It can just be this weird sort of story, and or non-linear story. And I would agree that a lot of my stuff looks narrative,
yeah.
as though there's, you know, you can turn the page and something else has happened. But and I think I approach it that way. I think drawing is natural to that response of, you know, I think drawing can be so many other things. But for me, drawing, you know, goes back to just like pencil and paper and just describing something sort of in an illustrative way. So I think it sort of hits it on the dot in terms of
yeah.
narration with my drawings.
Now, this is your first show in Indianapolis, as I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
At Wugluku's Studio and Garage. Can you give us a hint as far as what you're working on next?
See, that's what's funny is I always think of my work in series, and in my website,
mm-hmm.
it really categorizes my stuff as in series, but I don't usually show the transformation pieces.
Okay.
So what leads me from this series into the next series, just because they sort of don't make the cut. Like
mm-hmm.
something's weird, I don't really understand. So I'm in that phase right now of transitioning into either something, you know, away from the family farm, but I'm not really sure yet. I'm struggling with materials right now. I'm not sure if I want to go wet material or if I want to stay the dry material. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm transitioning.
Really, I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next. And welcome to Indiana. It's
Thank you so much.
To have you here, and I'm really looking forward to seeing this new show.
Thank you for having me.
Travesty Nicola with artist Jillian Ludwig. Her show Fam Farm opens at Wugluku's Studio and Garage, located in the Circle City Industrial Complex on Brookside, just off 10th and Mass Ave, on Friday, March 4th. More information is available at JillianLudwig.com, JillianLudwig.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Aaron J. Kernis, who has enjoyed a close association with the Minnesota Orchestra since 1992, is the founder and director of the orchestra's annual Composer Institute, an acclaimed professional launchpad for emerging composers. Born in Philadelphia in 1960, Kernis began his musical studies on the violin. At age 12, he began teaching himself piano and the following year composition. He continued his studies at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and both the Manhattan and Yale Schools of Music, working with composers as diverse as John Adams and Jacob Druckmann. Kernis will be in residence at DePauw University in early March, and Sharon Gamble spoke with him by phone to learn more about his work and inspirations.
Well, I have to say, one could do worse to start a career as a composer than be born in Philadelphia, where one of the world's great orchestras is. Were you taken to hear classical music regularly as a child?
Well, I was taken actually to the home of the Philadelphia Orchestra's summer concert.
Mm-hmm.
Which used to be called the Robin Hood Dell and later became the Mann Music Center, and went pretty early, but I can't remember that very clearly. What was very clear was when I became very engaged in trying to go on Friday afternoons or whenever I could a little bit later on in my teens, and certainly that orchestra became very, very important in my in opening my ears to the sound of orchestra music.
Was there a particular piece or composer who spoke to you early that you said, oh, this changes the world for me?
There were two especially. One was Bach, and in the orchestra world, particularly Mahler's music, just sort of blew everything apart.
Mm-hmm. Boy, those are very different points on the spectrum of music, too.
Definitely. And the of course, the great thing about Bach, it can be in front of you, at your fingers, in violin music, and in music for just one instrument, whereas, you know, Mahler pretty much exists in the orchestra and needs to be heard on recording. So I had a lot of both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What drew you to the violin as your first instrument?
It was actually initially purely practical thing that the school orchestra was looking for kids and looking to grow larger, and through my very first violin teacher, I started harmony and theory lessons, and out of that really grew composing. So that first teacher of mine was very important to me, and at a certain point I gave up the violin and kept on playing the piano and conducting and doing other things like that. I just didn't seem to have the right combination of Maybe it was not starting early enough, really. But I think I didn't have the patience to just sit and practice for hours on end. And it turned out that writing my own new notes interested me a lot more.
Sure. How did you first realize you had some aptitude at composing?
Well, it was more, I think my teachers seemed to discover that. I just found the interest in it, and I became a kind of voracious reader of scores and started to buy as many recordings as my allowance would let me.
Aww.
And really started to have a great interest in hearing as much new stuff as I, well, everything was new actually at that point. But I was particularly intrigued by what was being written today.
Are there other musicians in your family?
No, it was. I have really no idea how this happened, other than I heard some concerts as a kid and just thought, wow, I'll start an instrument. Actually, my mother started me as a singer. That was a surprise. She, when I was 5 or 6. She started giving me voice lessons, of all things. And not a usual thing to do for a young child.
No, not at all.
And my parents just loved to hear music, but they had no playing abilities or interests. So I just kind of grew into a completely different area of of the world for them.
You know, one thing that's always struck me about your music is its depth and color drawing out of all sections of, you know, whatever ensemble you're writing for, orchestra or string ensemble or whatever. How do you do that? How do you write for instruments that you don't play?
Well, with most instruments, I have, you know, one develops a background either reading about them, hearing them in other composers' scores, or in a few cases, there are composers who actually take the time to sit down with each instrument and get a bit of a knowledge playing them and what it feels like to play them. I'm the first kind. I really did a lot of listening and over years developed a lot of familiarity with what instruments can do well, how to push them further. And so most of it was really through recording and reading.
When you, you've been affiliated with ensembles and great musicians truly around the world, but is there, in your mind's ear, so to speak, is there somebody for whom you compose if you're doing a work for, say, violin and orchestra? Do you have a particular violinist in your head, or is it more abstract than that?
Well, what usually happens is when I'm asked to write a particular work, it's either for an existing group or for a soloist, and whether a chamber music or orchestra piece. And so what I usually do is I try to get to know that soloist's playing and have some aspect of their, how I view their musical personality, rub off on the piece.
Mm.
And that certainly happened very much with the pieces I wrote for Joshua Bell and Pamela Frank and not just Lerner Sonnenberg. A lot of really my perception of what particularly thrilled me about their playing made it into the concept of the piece I would write for them.
It seems to me one of the advantages of musicians working with a contemporary composer is they can come back to you. If you, say, write a piece with Renee Fleming in mind, she can come back to you and say, this isn't working for me. Can we make some changes? Does that happen very often?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the collaborative part of it can be really wonderful and really get the best out of both. And I think some performers, once they get the music, kind of would like to see the composer just kind of disappear for a while, leave them alone. It's down there in the notes, but there are many times where it's really helps the piece and the interpretation reach its next level by the collaboration.
Especially if you get to go hear a rehearsal and maybe you say, I need to highlight the lower register of this voice or this instrument more because this person really has, that's their sweet spot or whatever.
Right, absolutely. And it was amazing in the case of Renee Fleming. Actually, before she performed the work I wrote for her with orchestra, I wrote it for piano, and I had the good fortune and terror of actually being her accompanist for a couple of days.
Oh, no pressure or anything.
and performing with her in Lincoln Center and close by.
You know, composing, despite the fact that we're talking about collaboration, the musicians for whom you compose, composing is, or it seems to me, could be a fairly solitary occupation. Is that true? What do you do kind of on a day-to-day basis for a support system or a, no pun intended, but a sounding board?
Well, it is very solitary, and I have a studio that I love working in with a lot of light, and that's very important to me. And in the process, really, the kind of traditional composer walk, you know, is very much part of my creative process, and listening and reading and giving myself time to reflect on, just kind of let my mind try to go to places it's never been before and imagine sounds it's never imagined before.
Hmm.
But certainly for the last nearly 8 years. I've had my twins, and being a composer is anything but isolated now with them around.
How old are they?
They're eight.
They're eight now, okay.
Yes, and so my time is actually very carefully guarded, in fact. And my wife is around. We're both working musicians, so we work in the house. You know, get ready, practice, and compose here.
Do you have those moments when it's not part of your schedule, not part of your time when you'd intended to write, but something comes to you?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand.
Let's say, most people who are engaged in any kind of music have regular times that they try to guard, and they try to go into the studio. This is my time to write. This is my time to rehearse. But do you ever have moments when you're, say, out at dinner and something comes to you and you just grab a piece of paper and write something down that occurred to you?
It happens from time to time, yeah. Not regularly, but definitely some sound will appear from time to time, and someone's cocktail napkin will be grabbed, and but usually I kind of retain those things without having to write them down. I just file it away and go back to it, and when I get home I'll jot down a little sketch or a little color idea or something like that. But more often it's I'll work pretty singularly on one piece, and if other ideas come about I'll jot them in the margins and put them away for the other month.
You're part of why we're having this conversation is you're going to be working with some students here very soon.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like best about getting out and going places and being the composer in residence or the guest lecturer? What does that do for you? Does that give you an inspiration at all?
Well, it's really exciting to see young performers get to know work they're unfamiliar with. And I'm especially looking forward to coaching them, and there is a lot of my vocal work, actually, and choral work being done at this festival, and it's been a while since I've heard some of the songs done in this way, and I'm very excited about that, and kind of getting a spectrum of pieces that I don't normally see put together in concerts like that, so I'm very excited about that, and to get to know more about the area and the school, their particular strengths, and I'm pretty excited that they've found a lot of willing young victims to engage with some, in some cases, some very challenging music.
Sharon Gamble with composer Aaron J. Kernis. Kernis will be in residence at DePaul University the first week of March, and there will be several concerts celebrating his music as part of his time there. For more information, visit depaul.edu and then /music/calendar. So go to depaul, that's depaw.edu, and then you'll find music and the music calendar for Aaron J. Kernis. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
You know what? We're about to do that calendar thing that we call
What Do We Do?
But often people ask me, how do you find out,
how do we do it?
How do we do it? Well, the thing is, what I really want to emphasize is we get the ideas from you, and it's always best when it's actually from listeners of the program who send us an email or drop us a line and let us know, what's going on, whether it's with an arts organization or an individual artist or a church or other organization.
Mm-hmm.
And just to make it really clear, the best thing to do is to send us an email. You can go online to WFYI.org under radio and local programs. There's a page for Art of the Matter. You can submit stuff directly there, or you can just send us an email to
artofthematter@WFYI.org.
Exactly.
No the at the beginning. Just
no the.
Art
just
of the Matter.
artofthematter@WFYI.org. And let me give you a hint. What really helps Sharon and I is when you put a date on it, and a location, and a short description of the event, because it's not always possible for us to go searching the web to get all that, from there if there's just a link to a website or a phone number. So try to put as much of the specific information in those emails, and that really helps us out.
Can you tell Dear listeners, that both of us are former PR directors.
Oh, you're giving it away.
Oh, we are indeed.
So that's our PR lesson for today. But
fabulous people have done exactly what you just described, and that's how we know about a lot of great events that we can tell you about.
On that calendar we call, What Do We Do? Yeah, what do you got this week, Sharon?
Well, actually, one of my favorite all-time vocal ensembles, the King's Singers, are in town this weekend, Sunday night.
Is that not so cool?
7:30. They are just amazing. And, of course, they've been together for so long that there have been multiple iterations of the King's Singers. And they've done everything from pop tunes to Gesualdo madrigals and everything in between. Right now, they are featuring their new album, Swimming Over London, as well as a variety of that repertoire they're famous for from the Renaissance to today. You can go to brownpapertickets.com. Tickets range from $20 to $40. Again, they're Sunday evening, 7:30, at Christ Church Cathedral on Monument Circle. And, boy, don't miss your opportunity to hear them live.
Yeah, very, very cool stuff. And you know what is really neat is they're actually doing a master class before the concert. And a whole bunch of students from North Central High School, I know, are going to be participating in that in, like, a glee-like experience that they're having with the King's Singers. I mean, how cool is that, too? And those are things that we got. People sent us emails to Art of the Matter
they
at FYI
so did.
For. That's right.
What else is going on?
Hey, something I want people to know about, of course, there's lots of great gallery openings for First Friday coming up next weekend, including Jillian Ludwig, who you maybe heard the interview a little bit earlier on. There's also Emma Overman is having a new opening at the Harrison Center. And up and down Mass Avenue, they are celebrating Mardi Gras Mambo. And it's sort of a pre-Fat Tuesday event with Mass Ave merchants tossing out beads and having live entertainment up and down the street and in-store specials. And I hear there's even going to be a King Cake Truffle at Best Chocolate
oh,
in Town.
Oh, I read about that. I'm so excited.
So lots of
that.
Fun stuff on Mass Ave next Friday night.
In addition to First Friday, of course.
Yes.
And actually, let's segue to that because there's something very cool. IDOTA, Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealers Association, is doing the usual thing that it's doing at this time of the month, preparing for First Friday on March 4th. But they're also specifically preparing for their fifth annual First in Line exhibition and sale, which will be held at the Indie Artist Colony space. That's the new space you heard about on the Art of the Matter a while back and hope you've been to already.
It's on Pennsylvania Street.
On Pennsylvania, specifically at 26 East 14th Street, 14th and Penn, right behind the old WFYI stations. The way this works is IDOTA is trying to get all artists and supporters who want to donate original works of art in any artistic medium. The event lasts just that Friday night, March 4th. Each work is priced at $100 and is available for purchase on a first-come, first-served basis. So that's the way it works, and if you're a contributing artist who's interested, go to idata.org, that's IDADA.org, and if you're an art consumer, just be prepared that night. Bring your cash or plastic or a check, and be ready to stand in line and get the works that you want.
Very cool. Very cool. There you go. Hey, and if perhaps you live north and aren't coming downtown for First Friday and instead want to go check out something in Zionsville, then let me recommend a show that's opening also on First Friday at the Keller Mahaney Gallery, Contemporary Art, and it's featuring a show called USA Underdogs, Sidekicks, and Accessories. You get it, Sharon? USA?
I get it.
By artist Pete Brown, and his stuff is really cool. It's sort of like these pop culture illustrated, not quite graffiti style work featuring everything from Barney Fife and Robin and Tonto and Dirty Harry and Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Really cool work, and again, that's at the Keller Mahaney Gallery in Zionsville. They're having an opening on First Friday as well.
Very good. Here's something that kind of crosses lines between and among theater and poetry slam and with a little bit of a musical and visual art elements thrown in as well. It's Diaspora, and it is taking place the next couple of weekends, basically, at the Indie Fringe Theater building. It is based on poetry, the Dead MC Scrolls, written by Saul Williams. But it's been made into a one-man show starring Jonah Winston, who will be doing these amazing sort of poetic-based monologues. And what is a diaspora? Well, it's you know what it is. It's essentially the scattering of people away from their homeland.
Yeah,
and that's what inspires the Dead MC Scrolls. So, Indie Fringe Building next couple of weekends. You can get more information at halfblackproductions.com or indiefringe.org.
Now, I know a lot of people are getting excited, of course, for the Academy Awards this weekend.
May I have the envelope, please?
I'll give that to you in just a moment.
All right.
Let me read this teleprompter, and that says that if you want to...
Wait, are you ready for a wardrobe malfunction? I love the commercials where James Franco tackles...
Anne Hathaway?
Anne Hathaway with a blanket.
That's just like you and I.
Yeah, right.
So beforehand, before the Oscars on Sunday, you might want to go check out with your family. The Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra is presenting comedian Dan Kamen with the Classical Clown, a comedy concerto concert. And as the orchestra performs, this clown is going to be appearing throughout, basically battling conductor David Glover for control of the performance with magic and dance and physical comedy, and eventually taking over as the maestro. A lot of great music will be performed, but Dan Kamen's known really for his training of both Johnny Depp and Robert Downey Jr. in their performances in, respectively, Benny and June and Chaplin, and just a great talent, and this should be a lot of fun. 3 p.m. at the ISO on Sunday.
Very good.
And then you can get your close-up for your award.
That's right, that's right. Hey, there's going to be this cool event in mid-April. It's the Indiana Artisan Marketplace, the inaugural Indiana Artisan Marketplace, April 16th and 17th at the Expo Hall at the Indiana State Fairgrounds.
Yes.
And the organization is looking for volunteers. Folks need to be at least 16 years old or older. All volunteers get free parking, free admission to the show, and a t-shirt. But of course, even more than that, they get the pleasure of working on something cool. The Artisan Marketplace will feature about 100 artisans from Indiana and an additional 70 from Kentucky. It'll showcase art and food selected as being among the best in Indiana and Kentucky. I'll bet you know someone who's going to be in that.
There may be some chocolates at
there
that
show. There may be some chocolates
at
that show. Anyway, if you're interested in volunteering, go to indianaartisan.org, indianaartisan.org, and you can find the information there.
Very good. Well, we will have more things for you to do and eat and check out. I'm sure all those things. More things for you to do next week on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Art teachers Claire Dillahay and Leah Bly are concerned about the current state of funding for arts programs in the schools, and so as part of their graduate work in art education, they've created a website called whatartdoes.com. Travis DiNicola spoke with them about their work.
Claire, Leah, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both in our studio today.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start by asking you both to identify where you teach, what school you're at. Claire, where are you?
I teach at Jeremiah Gray Edison. That's in Perry Township.
Okay. And that's elementary?
Yes, K through 5th.
Okay. And Leah?
I also teach at an elementary school in Perry Township. I teach at Douglas MacArthur Elementary School.
Okay. Very cool. And so the two of you are here today mainly because, as art teachers, I know you're both very concerned about the role of and the place of arts education in our schools. Let's start by just sort of defining clearly what you're looking at when you're speaking of art education. You're talking specifically visual art, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, although I think Claire would agree with me that we think all of the arts are extremely valuable in education, but as art teachers and visual art teachers, I think that's where our experience and our expertise really lies.
Mm-hmm. But also, of course, I mean, you certainly recognize the importance of music and theater and dance and all that as well.
Absolutely. But. My sister is actually a bassoon performance. She plays in symphonies and things like that, so I highly value all of the arts, including theater, music, and visual arts.
Now, Leah, you've created a website regarding this issue. Tell me a bit about that. What prompted you? Tell me about the website and what prompted you to create this. Because I believe that this sort of came out of work that the two of you were doing in grad school. Is that correct?
Yes. For a master's degree class, we were supposed to create some sort of art advocacy campaign marker, whether it was stickers or bumpers. I created bumper stickers, mm-hmm. Posters, things like that. And through that campaign, we started, Claire and I and a few other people in the group decided, well, why can't we really do something meaningful with this? So I developed a website, whatartdoes.com,
mm-hmm.
To really showcase that. My and Claire's images are on there, as well as another student from that class. We've developed a way to download, for people to hopefully be able to download these images and stick them places. We're trying to get a billboard company involved so that we can hopefully post some of these images on billboards to really get the city of Indianapolis truly aware of the value that arts education has. We've also created a Facebook page,
mm-hmm.
So whatartdoes.com at Facebook. You know, you can like us, you can, nobody has yet, but hopefully people soon can upload pictures and upload other things that to help just promote this idea of the value of arts in education.
Sure. And Claire, there's also a song, right, that you worked on or were a part of?
Actually, the music teacher at one of the elementary schools in Perry Township,
mm-hmm.
created it. His name is John Staby, and I think the title of it is Vote Yes.
Yeah.
But it's a really great song, and it really encourages people to vote yes for the referendum in Perry Township.
Okay.
Well, due to budget cuts, the school board has proposed a referendum on the ballot for May 3rd. And if it is not passed, then art will be one of the things to go. And so we really want to urge voters to vote yes for Perry schools and to keep critical programs like art in the schools.
Now, obviously, I mean, art means a lot to both of you, or you would not have chosen to go into the profession of art education and becoming art teachers. But my guess is that through the course of your studies and also through just the practical work you're doing in the schools, it's obvious that you both recognize the importance that art has in so many other ways beyond just the making of an object that children experience and learn from in school. Tell me about what it is that you see. Why is art education so important for both of you? Why do you believe it's such an important subject to be included in the curriculum?
Well, if you ask someone what a student learns in art class, you'll usually hear, oh, they learn how to draw a picture or they learn how to paint. But that just only tells us what they do and not what they really learn to think. And when one of my students is making a work of art, it's an engaging process. And in that process, they're learning some really higher order thinking skills that they can use in other subjects and they can use later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
So skills such as observing something or expressing themselves, reflecting, envisioning, and these are all skills that they will need in order to face the future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they're behind a desk all day and all they learn is how to ace the test or learn, you know, fragmented skills, that's not going to help them. It might help them, you know, do well on a test, but it's not going to help them become original thinkers. And I think we're kind of losing that, and I think that's why it's really important to keep arts in schools.
Leah, you were nodding a lot with that.
Oh, yes, I absolutely agree. I think the arts teach kids, as Claire said, higher-order thinking skills. Tests and standardized tests have become so popular in grading schools and evaluating students. Don't evaluate how well students think, how well they process information. If our students are supposed to come and solve the problems that are going to be there in the future, they need to be able to think outside of answering and giving back information that they've been given. They need to create their own new answers. And art, all of the arts, visual arts, theater, dance, music, all involve creating new thinking through observation, through reflection, through envisioning. And so those higher order thinking skills are really truly valuable in a way that most people don't truly understand or taught through the arts.
Do you sometimes feel like it's an uphill battle, though? I mean, there's so much emphasis, of course, on standardized tests and what needs to, you know, just be taught to prepare kids for those tests, that often the arts, music as well, physical education, are sort of an easy target to be cut out of a school's curriculum.
Yes, they are. I think that's why we're really here, because we know that our township and many other townships are struggling with whether or not arts and PE, music and PE, are really valuable enough to keep in the curriculum, and that's why we really felt it was important to come down here, was to tell people that how truly valuable the arts are. That if you take this out, yes, it may or may not give students more time to do better on a standardized test, but what does that really teach them for the future? For the future of this child, I think if you ask any parent, a parent's not going to want a kid to their own child to succeed on just a standardized test. They're going to want their own child to be the most well-rounded child that they possibly can be. And through the arts, through PE, through music, those skills can be developed much better.
Is there any, you know, specific example that comes to mind for either of you when you think about how the arts have made a difference in the education of one of your students? I mean, there's certainly plenty of studies out there, everything from like Champions for Change and such, that look at the importance of the arts education in the schools and how it affects kids and improves their ability to learn in other subjects, often making them more excited to stay in school, keeping them out of trouble, things of that nature. There's been a lot of studies by the RAND Corporation. But, I mean, just, you know, it's those personal stories that mean so much. I mean, you know, when you go into your classroom, you know, are there kids that you see that you just know that if it wasn't for the arts, that they'd really be struggling?
I know for me there's a lot of cases. As K through 5 art teachers, the longer you're in the school, the more you know the kids. And so I can think of students now that are in 4th and 5th grade that we go through, and through the years, they began as just, you know, with crude skills, and now by their 4th and 5th grade year, they've developed sophisticated observation skills that are really truly beyond what a typical 5th grader might have, particularly without the arts. So that's always very encouraging to see. But I also hold an art club in my school, and my art club is painting murals on walls. And there are a number of students in that program throughout the years that have been maybe sometimes could cause trouble or struggle severely in academic classes. But they come and they want to paint. They draw their ideas out. They paint on the walls. And they're the most responsible kids that I've ever seen. Even if they may not be responsible in another setting, I let them go, and they just do wonderful, amazing things. To the point where our school, you know, is starting to become this wonderful, creative building with all these interesting things on the walls, just because of these students who were given the opportunity to succeed somewhere they normally, when they might not succeed in other classes and other areas.
Claire, how about you?
Yeah, I think, you know, art is an environment where they can just be, you know, and it's okay to make a mistake, and there's no wrong answer or no right answer, and they can just be. And there aren't too many places in life that allow for this just being, so when they come into my room, they're able to express their inner visions. They aren't able to do that in other classes.
Do you feel that the resistance, or maybe the place where people understand the importance of art education the least, is it with the parents, or is it with the school boards or the administration, or, I mean, where is it that things sort of get confused here? Like, if you could talk right now to any of them, who would it be and what would you say?
Well, honestly, I think it's kind of a cultural thing in America. I think it's very American to think that science and math and really science, math, and language are the most important things, and everything else just kind of falls by the wayside. And I know that in a lot of other countries and a lot of other cultures highly value the arts. And some of these cultures are cultures that we see as competing against in the future. And so I think that they have it right, you know, and we need to mm-hmm. learn from what they see and what they value. And I think that's where my campaign about what art does is to teach people what art does for people, because I think it's just something that we don't know, something we don't value, because we don't know the importance of it truly.
Claire, anything you'd like to add to that?
I think she summed it up pretty well.
Well, at this point, I mean, you mentioned the referendum that's coming up. Certainly people can check out the whatartdoes.com website to find out more. What else would you encourage parents and other concerned citizens to do?
I would encourage everyone to contact whatever school district they are a part of, whether or not they have a student in that school district, and contact them, find out, is this something that's a problem, something that could fall by the wayside? There are many school districts that are having referendums. Some have had them in the fall and will continue to have them. Find out, is this a reason that the referendum has started? Is this something that could be on the chopping block for that district? I also encourage them to get on AEAI, that's Art Education for Indianapolis, or for Indiana's website. They have a lot of art advocacy campaigns out there. Also check out my website. Like us on Facebook. If they have some ideas for creative advocacy posters or something, mm-hmm. we'd love to send it in, and I'll put it up on the website as soon as I can, because we'd love to get some of these things done. If they don't have any ideas, print it out. You know, print it out at Kinko's, stick it on your bumper sticker, things like that, so that the more that we can get our voice heard for art advocacy, I think the better off we'll be.
Very good.
Thank you.
Well, ladies, thank you both very much for coming into Art of the Matter today, and greatly appreciate it. And best of luck, of course, with the work that you're doing.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with art teachers Claire Dillahay and Leah Bly. You can learn more about how to support the arts in education by visiting their website, whatartdoes.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll get a preview of the upcoming Cabaret at the Columbia Club season.
I'll find out how photos can give you social currency.
And I'll meet Music for All's new president, Eric Martin. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call...
What do we do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.